Hi, it's Len Testa from the Disney Dish Podcast, and this is our second March 2015 episode on the history of Disneyland from 1960-ish to 1964-ish. A quick show note before we begin. Jim and I were just down in Walt Disney World earlier this month recording all new live shows in the Magic Kingdom, Epcot, the Studios, and Animal Kingdom. The first of those shows, in the Magic Kingdom, is available now at disneydish.bandcamp.com. We recorded these shows in 4-channel surround sound stereo, and I'm telling you, they sound fantastic. Because it's in stereo, you'll hear Jim on one side of you and me on the other. There's tons of Magic Kingdom music in the background, too, and it's almost 90 minutes of just total Disney geekiness. It's fabulous, and it's available at disneydish.bandcamp.com. If you like what we do, and doing what we do takes money for plane tickets, hotels, food, and bail, throw Jim a couple of bucks for that Magic Kingdom walkthrough audio while you're at it. That would be cool of you. And thanks very much for listening. Welcome back to another edition of the Unofficial Guide at Disney Dish Podcast with Jim Hill. This is our second show for March 2015, and as we've been doing all year, it is our look back at the history of the Disneyland Resort. We're celebrating its 60th anniversary by breaking up its 60 years into 12, roughly 5-year segments. And in this part of the show, we're going to talk about the early 1960s at Disneyland. In order to do that, we have to bring on our historian. It is Mr. Jim Hill. Jim, how's it going?
Not bad, not bad. Though, to be fair here, again, and I apologize because I know we'd be doing 5-year chunks. This show's going to be a little special in that while we'll be referencing stuff that does happen 64, 65, it really is kind of a look into a really specific period in the company's history, roughly 1960 to or late 62, 63. And if you know anything about Walt Disney, this was a time where on both a personal professional level, it was a time of great triumph and turmoil. I mean, when this time started, you know, January 1960, this is when the accountants at Disney Studios were delivering the bad news to Walt that the company had just spent $6 million making Sleeping Beauty. And this animated feature, which took 9 years to make and had been released in the 70mm Technirama format, had taken in just over $5 million. As a direct result, Walt Disney Productions, for the first time in 10 years, had to tell its shareholders for the 1960 annual meeting that they'd lost money, $1.3 million to be exact. And coming in,
almost all of that is from Sleeping Beauty.
Yeah, I mean, it just they and in fact, it, you know, the other scary result of this is Walt had to turn around and gut the animation department. And, you know, in early 1960, Walt Disney Feature Animation went from 551 employees to 75. I mean, I'm serious. It stayed at that levels till the mid 1980s when Jeffrey Katzenberg and Michael Eisner came through.
It went from 500 to 75.
Yeah. You know, if you talk with veterans who worked at the studio during this period, it was a really, really black time. And people came into work and they found out because there was a pink slip on their desk. They didn't even get talked to.
If you got that many people, you can't. I mean, there's no personal touch.
I know. But, you know, there were people who committed suicide because of this. I mean, it was a really, really bad time. Now, a jump ahead 5 years. All right. The end of 1964. Again, here come Disney's accountants. Only this time around, it's 4 years after Mary Poppins has been released. You know, and in a weird sort of coincidence, Mary Poppins also costs $6 million to produce, but it made, depending on who you talk to, between $30 million and $33 million, which in 1964 dollars was the equivalent of $200 to $250 million.
So a legit blockbuster in today's terms.
Totally, and it was the cash flowing from that film that led to that sort of second flowering we saw at Disneyland in the mid-1960s. I mean, the opening of New Orleans Square and Pirates of the Caribbean, not to mention New Tomorrowland in 67, and even further out from that, the Haunted Mansion. That was, you know, 3 1/3 of the shows that Disney did at the 64 World's Fair came back to Anaheim. And when I say a third, I mean the dinosaur scene from the Ford Pavilion Magic Skyway.
That scene's been used like 16 times. It should count more than
God, yeah. It is the gift that keeps on giving. And in fact,
forget dinosaurs. They breed like rabbits. I mean, what? You know,
And you know, the really interesting part is just last week, I came across this thing, I think it was Gawker or some site, was pointing out that Tyrannosauruses and Stegosauruses lived in entirely different epochs. So it's one of these things where could never happen, all right? And yet this is the scene that Disney comes back to over and over.
I would also like to point out, though, that generally speaking, British nannies can't fly. And yet we all accept that in the
movie. Interesting point, Len.
All right, back to 1960. So Sleeping Beauty tanks.
Thank you, but Mary Poppins makes this mountain of money. In fact, Rolly Crump, you can actually hear this story. Rolly tells it's part of those, it's kind of a cute story CDs that sort of are the spin-off of that memoir that Rolly wrote with Jeff Heimbach. He talks about the meeting where Walt comes in at WED and basically tells the guys, you can build whatever the hell you want. We've got all of this Mary Poppins money pouring in. And in fact, to be honest here, that WED in the same period turns around and establishes its manufacturing and production office, which if you shorten those four words into their initial, MAPO, well, just by coincidence, those happen to be the first two letters of the words Mary and Poppins.
Sure.
Also during the same period, this is where Walt gets to meet his namesake, Walter Elias Disney Miller, who's born in November of 61. And so it's a happy time. But at the same time, this is the same period where Walt and Roy get into a business-related brawl that is so bad, they stopped speaking to each other for 6 months.
When did that happen?
This happened during the buyout of Disneyland, and I will get into great details fairly shortly. But yeah, the first half of 1961, they don't talk to one another. They've got office boys that run back and forth with memos and – you know, it's like, you know, Walt said this. Okay, we'll tell Walt that. And it's just – and the irony is this only happens because Roy is trying to protect his little brother. We now have to jump back to 1951 where Roy has been sent by Walt to go buy the rights to all of the remaining Oz books. So he reaches out to the family of L. Frank Baum, the author of The Wizard of Oz, and the 16 sequels. And
I didn't know there were 16 sequels.
Oh, God, yeah. He kept writing and writing. In fact, there's three books beyond that that were posthumously published that Ruth Thompson did a lot of work on. But, yeah, I mean, when L. Frank finally got a hit, he wrote it as far as he could go. I mean, there was a stage version of The Wizard of Oz, and, in fact, there was actually some talk, and this is one of those weird little filigrees of history where L. Frank is living in Hollywood at this time, mm-hmm. and he's talking about how he's planning on building an Oz theme park on an island off the shore of California. And it's one of these things where it's like, whatever happened to that? And where are those plans? Anyway, so Roy is dealing with the L. Frank Baum family and finds out, kind of to his horror, that they don't control the rights of the books anymore. They sold them off years ago. And to be honest, they're in kind of rough condition. And Roy couldn't help but see the parallels between L. Frank Baum and Walt, who both are really creative geniuses who, if you hand them money, immediately spend it.
Yeah.
It's just one of these things where he looks at his brother and figures, you know, that at this period, they're finally flush again. Cinderella had been released in February of 1950. This great gout of money had come in. But, you know, it was one of these situations he couldn't help but think.
Yeah, they're before the grace of God goes Walt, right?
Yeah, and what's going to happen to Lillian or Diane or Sharon if something happens to Walt?
Right.
So Roy comes up with kind of an ingenious plan. He goes to his brother and said, look, this company is now called Walt Disney Productions. Why don't you license your name to the company for 40 years? And in turn, let's sign you to a personal services contract and just locks down some very specific terms that, you know, you get $3,000 a week, and more to the point, you'll get 5 to 10% of what the company collects for the use of Walt's name on anything other than film production. And again, as a safeguard, because again, he's still, you know, there's fresh memories of the L. Frank Baum family.
Yep.
He sets up a $1.5 million life insurance policy, which Walt can borrow against if he likes. Oh, and Walt likes.
Walt borrows against this. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the fact that that's what Roy honestly didn't understand is that, you know, it's like, and here's some heroin for you, Walt. because Walt is now getting serious about Disneyland. So as soon as he finds that he can borrow against his insurance policy, that's what he does. He borrows $250,000 against his $1.5 million insurance policy. And I will tell you, Lillian was not happy about this. In 1964, Walt recounted that the wife raised the dickens with me. She wanted to know what would happen to her if something happened to me. But the other thing that's important to understand here is that this personal services contract was just for 7 years. But things got busy, and, you know, obviously with Walt Disney Productions and by the late 1950s. In fact, the Disney brothers didn't get back around to talking about extending this personal services contract till the early 1960s.
Oh, wow.
And in between, well, again, it was just one of these things where it's something that the brothers had set up, and it was a can that they kicked down the road. In the meantime, Walt had set up WED, the company that he personally owned and operated, that then designed all of the rides and attractions for Disneyland. And as 1960 gets on...
Yeah, I guess this is a corporate reporting nightmare.
There you go. Right. And again, all out of, you know, an elderly brother's kindness. All right, so anyway, 1960, getting underway. WED's never been busier. June of that year, they just finished a $2.8 million revamp expansion of Disneyland's Rainbow Cavern Mine Train. The Imagineers had taken this Frontierland attraction and expanded its original footprint by 7 acres. Walt had then had WED build 204 mechanical animals that took their inspiration from some of the Disney True Life Adventure films, Beaver Valley, Olympic Elk, Bear Country, and Living Desert. You know, Disneyland Horticultural Department goes nuts. They bring in 150 trees from different parts of the country to give this, the now what's called the Mine Train Through Nature's Wonderland, this extra sense of realism. By the way, just a little side note here. With this attraction was the very first time, if you go through press releases or news accounts of the opening of this ride, the word audio animatronic is used.
Oh, for the Mine Train.
Yeah, but it's important noting here that these are really just next generations of the animals that have been done for the Jungle Cruise. They have very limited movement. I mean, Bob Gurr worked on these things and, you know, still talks about how, you know, just wheels and cams and, you know, nothing quite as sophisticated as Lincoln or the Tiki Birds or anything like that. But you know, this is where the phrase entered the Disney vernacular.
Okay.
Anyway, a direct result of this redo is that this six-year-old attraction suddenly becomes the hardest ticket in the park. And in fact, it's kind of interesting the weird side effects that happened because of this, because Walt actually had to go out and buy this whole new batch of burros.
Donkeys.
Well, here's the thing, that previously, that the Rainbow Caverns, it's actually been two rides in one. There was a mine train that went through the mountain and saw some stuff, and there was also a pack mule version. That, you know, guests could, you know, this series of burros that were tied together, and guests could climb on the back of them and, you know, ride off into the foam mountainscape. In fact, there was actually a time when you could ride a stagecoach through the same space, but, you know, the stagecoach fell over on its side once too often, and it was like, I don't think we can have that ride anymore.
Okay.
So they open this new Mine Train Through Nature's Wonderland, this expanded version of Rainbow Caverns, and adults now want to take, you know, they want to see it by the mine train, and they want to ride the burros, and it just, and the problem is these adults are so much heavier than the kids who normally rode the pack mule that the poor little burros couldn't do it anymore. And so, you know, Walt had to turn to Owen Pope, who actually ran the pony farm at Disneyland. There was this 6.5-acre complex out back where the horses that pulled the trolleys and that sort of thing were kept. And he had to go out, you know, instead of, you need to get a big, we're going to need a bigger boat. We need a bunch of bigger burros. So, yeah, so those came on board mid-60, early 61.
Okay.
By the way, there's an interesting story behind why Walt decided to revamp Rainbow Mine Caverns and turn it into the Mine Train Through Nature's Wonderland. He was supposedly standing outside the entrance of the Jungle Cruise when this mother and a little boy came up. And, you know, they paused for a moment in front of the entrance of this Adventureland ride, the Jungle Cruise, and you know, the son reportedly asked, you know, can we go on the Jungle Cruise? And the mom's response was, no, we saw that the last time we were at the park. And then she drags the kid off to something else. And, you know, Walt hears this and realizes that he, you know, the park's been open for a couple of years now, and he really does have to give guests a reason to return to rides that they previously experienced. So yep. This is actually where the concept of plussing comes from.
Oh, wow.
So, again, this not only compelled Walt to revisit the Rainbow Caverns ride in Frontierland, but given what the woman had said about Jungle Cruise, he told, you know, the Wed that, you know, we should be planning some new scenes for this Adventureland ride. So during the same period, this is when we saw the Sacred Elephant bathing pool added to that Adventureland ride. Likewise, the African Veld and the Trap Safari. Also, during this period is pretty much where the Jungle Cruise skippers started stepping away from the attraction's original spiel, which was really far more serious in tone and definitely took its inspiration from the True Life Adventure movies, and then became the more gag and pun driven narration we know now. The whole "we're approaching beautiful Schweitzer Falls," named for Dr. Albert Falls, that sort of stuff.
So did when they started going off script, mm-hmm. was that something that was did management know about it and approve it? Did they not know about it till it was too late? What happened?
It was kind of this simultaneous thing that was going on. I mean, Mark Davis came on board in Imagineering in 1962, mm-hmm. and he was the one who actually designed scenes like the Sacred Elephant Pool and that the Trap Safari and the African Veld. And Mark always put a lot of humor into his scenes, and it just over time, the fact that the scenes themselves became more humorous, and those scenes became the real highlight of the attraction, that they sort of began to backfill the narration for the other parts of the Jungle Cruise with gags. And face it, part of the thing is you're hiring young teenagers to take people out on boats. And after about the 15th, 16th tour of the day, you're tired of saying the same narration. And right. you're
a teenager. You don't.
Yeah. And it in a weird sort of way, it was an organic change that ran alongside of a mechanical change. They were physically changing, these scenes out in the, in the ride. And, because those scenes got laughs, it just sort of backfilled from there. to get back to Roy, Walt, pushing on Wed. And during the same period, Roy is trying to turn Disneyland into a business entity that's wholly owned by Walt Disney Productions.
So we talked about in a previous show that Walt had sold off literally shares of Disneyland to anybody that would give him money, and he was doing it at fire sale prices like ABC.
Oh God, yeah. Well, for example, Western Publishing, because of the money they put in 1953, mm-hmm. they wound up with 13.8% of the theme park.
Right.
They were the first ones that Disney bought out, and there was a reason they were first. As part of the deal for getting into Disneyland early, they had been awarded the exclusive rights to all Disney publications for 20 years.
Wow.
And so it was one of these things where it's like, that one, get that one off the table as quickly as possible.
How much did they end up making off the deal?
Well, that was the thing. They actually managed to get they got out from under Western Publishing, I think, for twice what they paid in, which my understanding, but you have to understand that trust me, when we get to what happened with ABC, that's a fire sale price. In fact, that the real problem with ABC is while the Western Publishing deal actually had buyout language in the contract, the ABC deal didn't.
Oh.
All right. And in fact, for the,
we're never going to break up.
Well, okay. This was the terms of the deal. ABC gave Walt $500,000 in cash to put to Disneyland. It also agreed to front, to back a $4.5 million construction loan. And for that investment, ABC got, 34.48% of the theme park, not to mention collecting everything that Disney earned off of its food concessions. And now you have to understand, part of this deal is that Walt also agrees to do television shows for ABC.
Right.
And as 55 gave way to 56, I mean, Disneyland, the television show was a hit straight out of the box. Mm-hmm. But as 56, gives way to 57, Disney is finding it harder and harder to deal with ABC executives.
Why?
Well, it, Davy Crockett had become a huge ratings hit. So the takeaway that ABC executives took from that was Disneyland television show should feature more Western content. So for example, the 57-58 season, Disney produced, and you have to understand that there were only the three Davy Crockett's the first season of the Disneyland television show. And the following year, they did two more, the Mike Fink episodes. All right. So again, total of five Davy Crockett's. That's it.
Okay.
But again, so ABC's like, oh, we need more of those. So, 57-58 season, Walt produces this 8-episode saga of Andy Burnett, which if, you know, it's kind of like what ABC just did with Marvel's Agent Carter. Again, just the notion of the self-contained story that can be told in 7 to 8 episodes, and not really a mid-season replacement like Agent Carter was. You know, they were sort of scattered out along the entire season of 26 episodes of the Disney television show.
Okay.
So Saga of Andy Burnett's a success. So what do the ABC executives do? They lean on Walt more and say that the TV show should feature even more Western-themed content for the 58-59 season.
This is a Who Wants to Be a Millionaire scenario all over again.
Absolutely.
In fact, 5 nights a week.
Okay, so for that season, Disney does 2 limited series, The Nine Lives of Elphago Baca and The Tales of Texas John Slaughter. And for the year after that, Len, mm-hmm. 18 of the 26 episodes of the Disneyland show at this point is now called Walt Disney Presents, which you'll understand why, given that, again, 18 of the 26 episodes are Swamp Fox and Daniel Boone. That means only 8 episodes for Disney Animation or stuff about the parks or anything like that. And Walt is just tired of producing Western content. And in fact, in the mid-1960s, as Walt's looking back on this time, he does an interview where he says, look, I found myself in a straitjacket. I no longer had the freedom that I enjoyed during those first 3 years of the Disneyland TV show. Those ABC executives kept insisting that I do more and more Westerns, which is why I found my Walt Disney Presents TV show competing in the ratings for ABC's other Western shows like Maverick and White Earp. And when I came to them with a fresh idea like this half-hour-long comedy about a boy who kept magically turning into a dog, network executive just said no. And he said, that sitcom idea they rejected, that became The Shaggy Dog. We made a theatrical movie out of that rejected idea and grossed $9 million for the studio.
Wow.
The Disneys are so unhappy at this point about the way things are going with ABC. By late 1959, early 1960s, Roy is filing an antitrust suit against the network.
Really?
Yeah.
What was the basis of the antitrust suit? Wow, I didn't know they sued each other.
Yeah, well, as it turns out, you know, you got to remember that during this same period, in addition to the Disneyland and which then became the Walt Disney Presents show, the company's also making the Mickey Mouse Club show, syndicate, you know, that afternoon kids show, mm-hmm. as well as Zorro. And what ended up happening is that ABC began pushing back against the production of the Mickey Mouse Club because, you know, it turns out for children's television, you can't get the higher ad rate that you can for adult television. And also, in the case of Zorro, it was one of these things where the ABC executive flat out told Walt, look, it's a quality show. It's been getting great ratings, but we could produce a similar show for a cheaper price. And it was just, the Disneys felt like they were getting in a tighter and tighter box with ABC.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah.
And so what they were, they were sort of artificially controlling what the studio could produce for television. So Disney was pushing back for, you know, the option to, if ABC rejected an idea, that they could then take it to another network. And to be honest, the other hidden agenda here, of course, is that what Disney was hoping was that if they got ABC in court and they sort of aired this dirty laundry about how, you know, ABC was preventing, you know, the creative genius Walt Disney from doing new shows and was forcing them to do Westerns, that it might then compel ABC to cut ties entirely with Walt Disney Production, which would then give them the opportunity to buy back that, you know, 34.48% of Disneyland that the network owned. And as it turned out, ABC did eventually fall for Roy's gambit. But it came at this a ridiculously steep price. In 1960, Walt Disney Productions purchased ABC's portion of Disneyland for $7.5 million, which was 15 times what they had initially put into the theme park.
Wow. So they, but that only valued the theme park at around $23 million.
You know, the interesting thing is, at least according to the book that Neil Gabler just did about the Disney company, Roy couldn't decide what the company was worth, what Disneyland was worth, so he kind of pulled the 7.5 figure out of the air.
Wow.
Kind of hoping that this was enough to dangle that ABC would bite. And in fact, evidently a half hour before he went into the final meeting with ABC, he got cold feet and called Walt. And it's like Walt said, look, do what you have to do. And actually at a 10th anniversary party at Disneyland, Walt, you know, in speaking to a group of cast members, said, look, in the end, we just figured, look, it was a huge amount of money, but if we don't pay it now, we're going to pay a whole lot more down the road.
So that's what it was. Yeah. I mean,
just bite the bullet and go. And even then ABC, had really stuck Disney's feet to the fire. They made the company at least honor the food concession part of it.
Really?
So yeah, the fact that ABC Paramount, that was the company that Disney had initially signed this deal with, controlled food concessions at Disneyland and got all of their profits. Till the summer of 65. So, you know, another 5 years of every hamburger you bought, that 19 cents went into ABC's pocket.
Wow.
You know, and even then, to add insult to injury, in order to pay off or to get the money to cover this, you know, unexpected $7.5 million, Disney had to go to Prudential and get a loan.
Why Prudential?
They were actually talking at that point, the two companies, about doing something for the World's Fair. And it was, Disney met with a lot of people in the early 60s that they didn't necessarily, go into the fair with. And Prudential thought, hey, look at us. Well, you'll like us, right? Just sort of, we'll agree to, to give you this money. I guess it came up in a conversation during that period that, Disney had just made this deal and I think had 30 days or 60 days to deliver the funds to ABC. And Walt mentioned it immediately, and some Prudential executive thought, I'll offer to do this, and that will get us in bed with Disney. And as it turned out, it didn't. But, all right. Anyway, so now comes the difficult part. Again, remember at the top of the podcast, mentioning the $250,000 that Walt borrowed against his life insurance.
Yep.
And okay. Again, because of that investment, Walt personally owns 16.55% of the theme park. Not only that, he owns all of WED. And since Roy wants Disneyland to be this wholly owned subsidiary of Walt Disney Productions, they bought out Western Publishing. They bought out ABC Paramount. It's now time to buy out Walt to eliminate any conflict of interest, or the appearance of conflict of interest.
Oh, that Walt owns Disneyland and is hiring WED.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay, so they don't want it to look like Walt is funneling, or that Disney is funneling, the Disney Corporation is funneling, allowing Walt to
feather his bed, so to
exactly,
speak.
Yeah,
I mean,
okay.
It's not really going to be a surprise. This negotiation did not go well, especially because Roy wanted Walt to sell WED to Walt Disney Productions. It was actually, in a weird sort of way, it was WED that Walt, Disneyland, he was very protective of Disneyland, but he was really protective of WED. He thought of that as his happy place. This was the place he went to get away from the stress of running the studio. More to the point, Walt was constantly putting his money where his mouth was in regard to Wed. I mean, for example, when the Imagineers was struggling to get the Lincoln animatronic to work in early 1960s, Walt took $250,000 out of his personal savings account. Again, without letting Lillian know prior to doing this.
Wow.
To further research on the figure. Anyway, so this goes on for a year. They keep having conversations. By January of 61, it gets serious. The brothers are out at Smoke Tree Ranch for a weekend.
We've been there. You and I have been there.
There you go. Together. All right. Yes. And I got to talk to Diane Disney Miller about this once, and she recalled the brothers screaming at each other. You know, they're a room over, and the family can hear this whole really awful conversation going down. And to her personal memories, this is the worst exchange that had ever occurred between the brothers. Wow. And so Walt and Roy stopped talking to one another. And as I mentioned, you know, that just communicate through intermediaries. And this goes on for 6 months.
Wow.
All right. And it only ends when Walt's attorney threatens to get Walt an agent. I mean, you know, just that and then offers creative services to other studios, that Roy finally concedes just enough points to make the Disneyland acquisition easier for Walt to swallow. Okay, end result is a brand new 7-year contract. Walt is now paid $3,500 a week. That's $500 up from his previous contract. Mm-hmm. He also gets paid $1,500 a week for his design services at WED.
Sure.
So, you know, that's showing that he respects that, you know, what Walt is doing, at least on that side of the fence. And now while WED and Disneyland become wholly owned subsidiaries of Walt Disney Parks, Walt retains complete ownership of Disneyland steam trains and monorails through Retlaw, along with the use of his name and his facial likeness. And, of course, Retlaw, for those of you who know, is Walter spelled backwards. In a weird sort of way, this was the genius touch of Roy because, I mean, remember, this is Walt who used to run the miniature steam train around the backyard of his Homey Hills home. So that Roy knew that it was important to Walt to retain ownership of the steam train and the monorail. I mean, this is a guy who clearly knew his brother. Let's just be honest here. If you take the 30,000-foot view of Disneyland, uh-huh. It really is the world's largest train set. I mean, you know, in fact, there's people at Imagineering who still argue that Walt basically built Disneyland in the first place because he was tired of running teeny tiny steam trains in his backyard, and he kind of wanted what Ward Kimball actually had at his Grizzly Flat set up out in San Gabriel, California, which was a full-size steam train that he could run around this set of narrow gauge track in his backyard. Well, anyway, so this finally gets settled. The brothers are talking to one another again, and the first year that Walt Disney Productions is wholly owns Disneyland, that would be the summer of 61 into 62. It makes the park makes a $13 million profit. By 64, this has jumped to $24 million. Meanwhile, again, Walt, because he keeps hearing his head, that woman who wouldn't take her son on the junk cruise because they all had already seen it, he's plussing the park wherever he can. So, for example, December of 1960, the Jolly Roger, that boat-shaped building toward the back of Fantasyland that used to house the Chicken to the Sea restaurant, mm-hmm. That gets a Peter Pan themed backdrop, a giant version of Skull Rock and Pirate's Cove. And by March of 61, you know, he's enhancing Sleeping Beauty Castle by building the Snow White Wishing Well and Grotto, which has since gone on to become a popular place for people to propose at Disneyland.
Oh, nice.
And at the same time, because now he wants his wholly owned, you know, monorail to go different places, Walt spends $2.5 million to expand the monorail route out to the Disneyland Hotel. And it's interesting.
Wow, $2.5 million just to make it go to the hotel.
Well, and what's interesting is he does this without charging the Rather Corporation, which, remember, built the Disneyland and the hotel and operates it, on a handshake deal with Walt because, you know, Walt needed a hotel next to his park. He doesn't charge the Rathers a single cent.
So they get monorail service for free.
For free. But that's just because, you know, he thinks that being allowing people who are in the park to travel and see, you know, a monorail out in the world is an enhancement. And more to the point, it then becomes this thing of, oh, well, you got to stay at the Disneyland Hotel because the monorail, you know, takes you there. Mm-hmm. It's sort of the gift that keeps on giving. And speaking of sense, it's at this point, I really want to bring up something that I think is worth noting, especially in the era where, we've just seen the admission price to a Disney theme park go over $100 a day. Okay. When Walt was sincerely concerned about what it would cost the average family to go to Disneyland, which is why wherever possible, he not only added free exhibits to the parks, he deliberately kept costs down. I mean, for example, a ride on the new the Fantasyland merry-go-round in 1955 cost 10 cents. Mm-hmm. Jump ahead a decade, and it's still 10 cents. And not only that, kids under 3 ride free. Not only that, and this is again, with all your work in the unofficial guide, and especially now where you look at things, you know, like, for example, the expansion of New Fantasyland at Walt Disney World or the enhancements of the hub that are being made so you can pour ever more people into this theme park. I think you're going to find these series of quotes just fascinating. All right. Okay. July 4th, 1964. 60,000 people cram into Disneyland for the day. Walt gets word of this. And again, these are actual quotes, all right? Walt thinks that's too many people. You know, he says, park managers that think 40 to 50,000 inside Disneyland is a proper number. I prefer 30,000. That way, everyone gets a chance to ride.
Walt, you country bumpkin from Kansas, you.
Well, listen to this. Again, this is one of the reasons why I love to dig into old newspaper accounts rather than sort of the varnished, edited Disney history.
Yeah.
Because when you get the raw Walt, when you get the unfiltered Walt, it's fascinating. I mean, for example, take for instance this quote about Disneyland. We take nothing out of Disneyland, as you know. Every cent gets plowed back in, and we're spending a few million over the next few years to improve it. This park takes most of my time and money. I make more money off of a new movie than I do in a year at Disneyland. And this is a direct quote, Walt Disney, San Francisco Chronicle, February of 1965.
Wow.
So, again, this is Walt's train set. And I apologize, but this is where the train trip ends today, folks. We'll pick up again in 63, which is, so those of you know, this is when Walt got serious about audio animatronics. This is Tiki Bird Country. Mm-hmm. And again, in the next show, we'll talk about, you know, the way Walt was running the company right up until he passed in December of 66. Going forward from this time, this is when Walt gets serious about audio animatronics. We're not going to see the minimal animal movements that we saw in Nature's Wonderland or the Jungle Cruise. This is Tiki Bird Country. This is Lincoln. But we'll get that and, you know, get to that storyline in our next show, which sadly takes us to when we lose Walt. But that's a story for the next time.
That'll be our cliffhanger. All right, thanks for this history lesson, Jim. This is very good. You've been listening to the Unofficial Guide Disney Dish podcast with Jim Hill. Please go onto iTunes and rate our show and tell us what you'd like to hear next. As a reminder, Jim and I will be in Walt Disney World soon, if we're not there already, and we will have lots of upcoming episodes for you on that topic. Also, go on to disneydish.bandcamp.com to listen to older shows and also special shows that haven't been released to iTunes. For Jim, this is Len. We will see you on the next show.
Take care.